Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Rappucci here on behalf of Mr. Marion Jeton, the appellant in this matter. At first glance, this case appears a pretty familiar scenario. An indigent defendant expresses dissatisfaction with his appointed counsel. The trial court does not inquire adequately, and then the defendant claims reversible error on appeal. Most of these cases seem to come out the same way, which is that the defendant's unable to demonstrate a complete breakdown of communications, and therefore that he was entitled to substitute counsel, and then he's denied relief on appeal. The case before the court today presents a more unique set of circumstances, and that is because that the date on which the failure to inquire occurred was probably the most critical date of the entire proceedings. It was the mandatory plea disposition date. This case, I really want to impress upon the court, I'm sure the briefs have, but this case is not just simply about substitution of counsel and denial of substitution of counsel. It's really about a fundamental denial of the right to counsel altogether and the right to both procedural and substantive.
Isn't that argument raised on the first appeal, counsel?
It was raised but not addressed.
Was it implicitly rejected when they decided to remand for a hearing as opposed to just outright reverse?
Well, I can't speak for what the court implicitly rejects. If it was rejected, I think it was an erroneous rejection because it's a meritorious claim, and these are serious constitutional rights that we're discussing.
Do you have an opportunity to petition the Supreme Court for certiorari on that issue in that case?
I did, Your Honor.
And did you petition for certiorari on that
I
issue?
I did, Your Honor.
At this point, I guess I'm wondering, you know, we had given some remand instructions in that prior case. Aren't we bouncing the trial court back and forth if we say, oh, just hold a hearing? And now we'd say, oh, I guess you're right. You should have reversed the case the first time when this case came up originally.
No, I don't think that's quite right, Your Honor. And Your Honor, I remember vividly, Your Honor, Judge Daly was on the original panel, and I remember a few things pretty vividly about that oral argument. I actually tried to get on there today and listen to it, but it wasn't available. And one of the things that I remember vividly, and perhaps I'm jumping ahead, was a question by the court as to whether or not a remand, why that would be inadequate, and citing you to the Kellen case, which I had not cited in my briefing. And so I did not, you know, I wasn't particularly in touch with what the Kellen case ruled. I guess where I'm going with that is Kellen, clearly the court, Kellen is the law. Bergerud says that Kellen is the law in terms of a remand being the appropriate remedy in the first instance. We've had that remand. The facts have now been developed in the court below sufficient so that this court can now address the merits of the argument.
And that's correct. But as I understood your other arguments, due process, procedural, and substantive due process, he was denied substantive and procedural due process back at the original failure to address the issue of substitution of counsel. And for that alone, we should reverse the case. That was what I was asking you about, counsel.
I'm sorry, I don't think I understand the court's question.
Well, I don't want to take up any more of your time.
Okay.
With that.
Yeah, I think the court's point is you have considered that. I think clearly perhaps you have implicitly rejected it.
Let me try that a different way if I can, Mr. Rappucci. As I understood the prior division's ruling, it specifically said there was a specific remand to determine if there was a complete breakdown in communications. And the court said, the division said, if the trial court rejects that, the decision will stand affirmed. So I think it's more than just implicit. The sole purpose for this remand was to decide if there was a complete breakdown in communications, I think. Correct me if that's wrong.
I think that was the sole. I think that's correct.
Okay. And so maybe I can, I'm stuck the same place I think Judge Daly was. I'll try come at it a different way. And perhaps I'll ask a broader question. And that's, I'm not quite sure I'm understanding your principal argument here on this complete breakdown was that the court misapplied the third Bergerud factor, as I understand it. you talk about how counsel couldn't bind Mr. Jaton while there was the motion to substitute pending. You talk about how Mr. Jaton was the one who had the right to say, yeah, I agree or don't agree to the disposition. I'm not catching the connection, or missed it, between the, how those things show that the court misapplied the third Bergeron factor. Can you help me with that, and maybe that'll get to this to the same place?
I'll do my best, and I think one of the keys, perhaps this goes back also to Judge Daly's question, and why there, if there was an implicit rejection of the due process claim, I think that rejection needs to be reevaluated in light of Bergeron, because Mr. Jaton is entitled to retroactive application of Bergeron. And Bergeron provides a lot of guidance to this court on the substitution of counsel. And what specifically I think is critical about Bergeron is it makes very clear that when an indigent defendant files a motion for substitution of counsel, he is no longer allocating authority to that attorney to bind him on any position.
On any position, Bergeron goes that far, or he's no longer allocating authority to the lawyer with respect to whether the lawyer should continue on the case?
Well, I think Bergeron is probably not intended to be overly broad, but I think the logic there is, if you're trying to fire your attorney, you are explicitly, and you have in fact done that, and you're asking for permission to do that, then you're no longer authorizing that attorney to make representations on your behalf. And so what I'm trying to get at, this critical date, on May 14th, Mr. Jaton under Bergeron was proceeding pro se. Yet, the court did not allow him to participate in the proceeding.
He was proceeding pro se with respect to all issues, or just the issue of substitution of counsel?
Well, the easy answer would be to just to, on the substitution of counsel, but I think it's really difficult to unscramble that egg, Your Honor. The fact of the matter remains that he was trying to request substitution of counsel. He perceived a complete breakdown of communication. He perceived a conflict of interest that was affecting his right to effective assistance of counsel and to counsel. So when which this court certainly will either accept or reject, my idea is that Mr. Jaton was proceeding pro se at that hearing. Had the trial court followed the law, discharged his duties in an appropriate manner and not abused his discretion, there would have been an order, presumably based on the remand, that Mr. Jaton did not have a right to substitution of counsel. But unless or until that order entered, Mr. Jaton was proceeding pro se. And so if the court, which the court did very tersely, I might add, in this case, tells the defendant, who's indigent and seeking to do nothing more than to assert and exercise meaningful constitutional rights to counsel, the trial judge said, thank you very much, Mr. Jaton, sit down. He said it twice. He told him to sit down and shut up. That's what happened. Not quite as tersely as that, but quite tersely. So we have the most critical date in the proceedings when Mr. Jaton is not allowed to speak to the court, not allowed to address the court, and therefore not allowed to participate in the proceeding. The records on the remand, at least according to Mr. Jaton, was that he had not discussed the plea bargain with his counsel on that date, that the sole interaction with his counsel on that date was saying, hey, you know, what are you doing here? I'm trying to fire you.
To suggest is the burden on the defendant in such a case. I mean, the case is postured as one for a substitution of counsel, a counsel to replace the current counsel. This isn't the situation where a defendant stands up and says, you're fired, he can't speak for me anymore. What's the trial judge supposed to assume is the relationship?
Well, Your Honor, the trial court's not supposed to assume that there is a relationship. It's very clear what the trial court's supposed to do. The trial court is supposed to conduct a thorough and searching inquiry. And so Mr. Jaton didn't have an opportunity to say, I want to fire this guy, or he didn't have an opportunity
to have it explained to him, look, you're not getting a new counsel. If you file him, you're proceeding pro se. He just was told to sit down. And so this date on which he personally had to either accept or reject the plea bargain, he never had an opportunity to do it.
Isn't your position, counsel, then every time that the judge makes an error in not inquiring of the request to substitute, automatic reversal, structural error?
No, Your Honor.
No.
No, Your Honor. That was where I tried that one once before on the original case. That is not my argument. And in fact, I think Bergerud and Kelly make very clear that argument's not going to go anywhere. It's incorrect. My argument is, and I think this is really important, that this case is a very unique set of factual circumstances. It's kind of a confluence of the denial, the improper failure to inquire with a critical stage of the proceedings. And so my argument is that a remand in this situation, you know, everything that happened on remand doesn't change the underlying fact that happened. All it does is it sheds light on it. And so because Mr. Jutani is not allocating authority to his attorney, the court, if it was, you know, if the court had simply discharged its duties appropriately, it wouldn't have been a problem. And that's why I think that this case is not going to be a floodgate case. And I'm not advocating for a bright line rule like that. This is a unique case because what we have here is, one, the trial court not following clearly established law to discharge his duties in the appropriate manner. So that's not going to happen very often. It's pretty well settled what a trial court is supposed to do in this circumstances. We also have a mandatory disposition date, which is not going to be frequently. I don't think there's any published case in Colorado which deals with the same thing.
It's a mandatory disposition date, which had been extended at the defendant's request so that the defendant could consider another alternative option to going to trial. That's not a circumstance that ought to be considered by anybody?
I don't believe that circumstances changes the fact that as a matter of law, Mr. Jutani was not represented by counsel at that proceeding and not allowed to participate in it. It was the most critical stage in the proceedings. He needed to personally either accept or reject the plea, and he was not given that opportunity.
Mr. Appucci, if I can interrupt you, I know you have very limited time. The argument you're making, I understand, and it seems to me to go to the right to counsel and due process arguments that may or may not be for us. I'm still not seeing, going back to where I started, how does this fit with the complete breakdown of communications? That was what the remand order was for. The court made extensive findings about that. And so I'm not assuming, I know you disagree, assuming we can't get to this right to counsel and due process argument as separate arguments. How do those play into or fit with Bergerud?
Okay. First, before I assume that, the third factor of Bergerud is intended to focus on whether or not there was a constitutional violation in the first place. Whether that prevented an adequate defense or the complete representation by counsel at that critical stage in the proceedings. That's what the third factor is about. And what happened here was, in order to have an adequate defense in this case, you needed to either accept or reject the plea. And so Mr. Jutani did not have that opportunity. The court erred in putting that inquiry to the attorney who was no longer had authority to represent Mr. Jutani. And the attorney, that's not really before this court on the effective assistance of counsel, but I think we all know probably where this case is going to go. The attorney erred in answering that question. The appropriate thing to do would have said, Your Honor, my client has moved to fire me. We need to deal with this before I can bind him. And that didn't happen. And so the third factor is implicated. And that's why I think, and to focus the court's inquiry, I think the record, I'm not quibbling with the trial court's findings on the totality of the representation. But there was a complete breakdown of communications, a very serious one, that took place between May 7th and May 14th, with it culminating in May 14th with a critical stage in the proceedings where the client is neither represented by counsel nor allowed to participate pro se. And that's a serious constitutional problem. and it was very harmful in this case. It was very harmful. And that, you know, Kelly and Amber would make the point that you do have to assess these violations for harmfulness. And this is a situation, a unique situation, where a remand doesn't provide a remedy. It provides more information for the court to consider, but it doesn't provide an adequate remedy. And that's where we get into the Carmichael case, which of course is a bit different. But it does deal with the remedy in this terms of prejudice, in terms of prejudice that results in errors in the critical stage of plea bargaining. Thank you.
May it please the court, Wendy Ritz, registration number 17024, representing the people in this matter. The issue presented today is whether the trial court properly determined that the defendant failed to show a complete breakdown in communication with his attorney. On direct appeal, the defendant had asserted that the trial court erred in denying his motion for substitution of counsel without inquiring into the reasons for his dissatisfaction. This court agreed, but rejected the defendant's assertion that the trial court's failure to inquire automatically mandated a new trial, instead ordering a remand by hearing on his claim. This court's decision made clear that the defendant had the burden to show that there was a complete breakdown in communication, and that in resolving this issue, the trial court could consider events both before and after the defendant made his complaints. On remand, the trial court did just as this court ordered, holding an evidentiary hearing, considering the testimony of the defendant and his trial counsel. Based upon that evidence, the trial court properly determined that the defendant and his attorney had continued to communicate throughout the pendency of this case, and correctly concluded that the defendant had failed to establish good cause for the substitution of counsel. While the defendant now would like to kind of reopen a lot of the things that happened on direct appeal, I don't think those issues are before the court at this point.
Well, let's take an issue that is before the court at this point. What about the argument about the breakdown in communications between counsel and defendant between May 7th and May 14th?
Okay. The defendant's claim does seem to focus on that. On May 7th, they had the first mandatory disposition hearing, at which the defendant decided he wanted more time to speak with his family about the plea. After speaking with his counsel and learning that he was going to have to waive his motions, he ultimately decided he wanted the extra week. He got the extra week. During that week, his attorney sent him a letter, which apparently did not get to him in a timely fashion, and the defendant sent a motion and a letter to the court saying, I'm unhappy with my attorney. My attorney waived my motions. I'm really unhappy. My attorney's pressuring me. I don't feel like we're communicating that sort of information. So that all happened during that period. Admittedly, it does not appear that defense counsel met with the defendant, but the defendant's assertions throughout had been, I would like to talk with my family about these plea offers. It doesn't appear that it was that critical that he wanted to talk with his attorney. If you look at the remand evidence, it was clear that his attorney had been talking with him about this stuff throughout.
May I ask you, Ms. Ritz, you've just indicated, I think the record would show we don't see anything that there was any discussion in this critical week. What is the basis for the defense counsel to say there was no disposition? How does he know?
Well, the problem, I think, is that defense counsel can't really remember what happened that day. I think we can all sort of understand that. He had a lot of cases. But from his understanding of how he conducted his practice, he knows that he would not have made these representations to the court had he not discussed this with his client. Well, the defendant immediately got up and said, no, nobody talked to me. When asked, defense counsel does not say, I have not had a chance to talk with my client, my client won't talk to me, nothing like that. He says there's no disposition. And while that's not as satisfying as the attorney being able to remember it, I think the record supports the fact that his attorney had discussed it and defendant had agreed there was no disposition. Particularly if you look at how contentious this defendant was. He called prosecutors, he called investigators, he knew how to make his wishes known. Yet once this mandatory disposition date passed, he never again mentioned a guilty plea ever throughout the proceedings. At sentencing, he got up and talked about he was unhappy with his lawyer who did this and the way the trial came out, but he never once said, you know, what I really meant to do all along was on that disposition date, I really wanted one of those plea offers. He never said that anywhere throughout all the time, even at sentencing. And his attorney's testimony suggests he didn't really like these offers. He laughed and was outraged at the 20-year offer. If you look at the correspondence from the defendant, it's clear that what he wanted was a 5-year drug program sentence. He wanted something he was never going to get, and he was holding out for some sort of sweet plea deal, which never came along. All along, he'd been talking about his motions. It was clear he was looking ahead to trial. He was really concerned about his motions. I just don't think on this record there's anything that suggests that his attorney overpowered his will and said, no, he doesn't want a plea, and he went along with it only because he was forced to, because it never came up again. Never.
Counsel, let me ask you, in evaluating the issue of complete breakdown of communications, do the cases help us determine any particular time frame? Is it like over a particular day, the day in question, a week in question, the course of the case leading up to the motion? Do the cases give us any kind of clue as to whether we're looking at short time frames or overall time frames or anything like that?
Well, I think if you look at the language the cases use, a total and pervasive and that sort of language, I think the fact that you are not getting along one day is not enough to satisfy a total breakdown in communication. I mean, the case law makes clear that you do not have a right to serve a meaningful, friendly attorney-client relationship. You have the right to an attorney who's looking out on your behalf, and this attorney was doing that. This attorney fought very hard for Mr. Chatan. It was a very difficult case. The court acknowledged that. And there's just nothing except for his self-serving testimony later at this remand hearing, at which he insisted, I would have taken a plea. At this point, when he's in prison for 96 years, admittedly, that 20-year plea now looks great. But at the time, he thought that was not such a hot deal, and he didn't want it. I think the record supports that.
Stan, Mr. Rapucci, his contention is the trial court should have made inquiry at the time of holding the sentence, that there was
enough there to alert the trial court that there was an issue here between counsel
and the court. That stage.
I think the defendant reads way too much into the Bergerud language. Bergerud essentially says when you file a motion expressing dissatisfaction with your attorney, you, as to that, you are representing yourself. Essentially, the language of that case says we have to construe these pleadings and actions liberally because the defendant is essentially representing himself as to that. There is no case law, no language in Bergerud or anywhere else that I can find that says once that happens, everything else stops, and the court must resolve that before his attorney can bind him as to anything else. I think there is some language in Samuels as to if there is an actual conflict of interest between the defendant and his client. That's a different situation, but that's not what we have here. And certainly it would have been better, and we encountered this problem a lot of time in cases where we wish the judges would inquire at the time. What the judge really was saying, I think if you read, it's a very short hearing, I don't think the judge was meaning to be rude or dismissive. The judge was saying, I do not have your motion in front of me, Mr. Defendant. When I see that motion, then we can talk about it. I think that's what was going on with the judge. He didn't have the defendant's motion. He felt that they would deal with it when he got the motion. And I don't think that's enough to constitute a denial of due process, particularly when the court reviews the motion, finds that it seems to be complaints about trial strategy types of concerns, issues in order. The defendant, who, as we know, speaks up for himself when he's concerned, said not another word, registered not another complaint about his attorney until sentencing. And at that point, again, in his concerns, never said, I really wanted to plead guilty and my lawyer wouldn't let me and my lawyer didn't properly communicate with me about that. So I think the facts we have here just don't jive with what the defendant is trying to say happened. You know, Admittedly, the defendant's testimony is all over the place, and that's part of the problem. Sometimes he says, I never understood the plea. Other times he admits, my attorney talked with me about the plea. Sometimes he says, I really wanted to take the plea. Other times he's complaining and saying, I really want these motions. I know we're going to win on the motions. His testimony is scattered and all over the place, but nothing in his testimony or in his lawyer's testimony suggests that there was this breakdown that day. His attorney spoke for him. The defendant never contradicted him. They went on to trial. The relationship appeared to be excellent throughout the proceedings. I just don't think we can get there from here. He's trying to kind of make this now into a, I wish I would have pled guilty if I had known better, but that's not really the issue that's before us, I don't think.
Nothing suggests that there wasn't a breakdown on that day. The fact that he had, tried to file a motion or was in the process of filing a motion a day or so before. The fact that either he said or his lawyer said, hey, he'd like to tell you he doesn't like me, want me, to represent him anymore. That doesn't suggest that there was some type of breakdown of communications that day.
If we follow that line of reasoning, then every time a defendant complains about his attorney, that would be viewed as a complete breakdown.
I'm not saying the evidence was sufficient to demonstrate it, but when you said there was no indication of it, okay. Even when there's some objection, that's not some indication of it?
I apologize, Your Honor, you're right. There was enough there for the court to understand. His attorney said, I think his attorney said something to the effect, the defendant has a motion he would like to file. And then they talked about the disposition, and then I think, actually I have the hearing right in front of me. So the court wanted to deal with the disposition, and then the defendant spoke up and said, I have filed a motion to dismiss counsel. And that's the point at which the court said, I don't have your motion. Please sit down, Mr. Jitan. I don't have the motion before me today.
Said Mr. Jitan does wish to address the court.
Okay, let's see.
That's the defense counsel. I think, there's no dispo today, but Mr. Jitan does wish to address the court. I have to say, I'm reading this on the cold record, does cause me some concern. Why does the trial judge tell him to sit down? He doesn't know what he's going to tell him. That was why I asked my first question. It caused me a little, I hear you. There was, seemed to be all over the map. I understand your point that he never says anything until later. But how do we know that he didn't want to stand up right then and say, I'm going to take the dispo? We're left to guess some, and that causes me some concern.
It's also kind of puzzling, though, if he wanted to take the dispo, why is he discharging his attorney? That seems to be puzzling in itself. If he's pleading guilty, at that point it would seem like it doesn't matter how he's getting along with the attorney anyway. He's pleading guilty, and it's essentially we're done. So it's something I've puzzled over. Certainly, cases like this where the courts are in a hurry and they just move on are very difficult for us to recreate later. But the remand was to sort of go over this territory and try to figure out what was going on. And other than the defendant's self-serving suggestions that what I really wanted to do was to plead that day, I don't think there's anything else in the record that supports that assertion. And it is troubling. It would be better if we knew, but I think we have to look at the record as a whole, and I think the trial court, in its remand, made the appropriate findings given the record before it. If there are no further questions, I would ask that the...
Do have a further question. Counsel, one of the issues I believe on appeal is contesting the trial court's finding that defendant declined to accept the plea offer, either plea offer or anything like that. Is that a finding you think that extends to defendant personally declined to accept the plea offer? You didn't ask it personally, but instead of defendant through defense counsel, but defendant declined to take the plea offer.
You're asking if the court's language suggests that?
Yeah, the defendant himself didn't want to take it. Is it a finding that defendant didn't want to take the plea offer?
I'm trying to remember what the trial court's exact language was. Mr. Jackson declined to accept either offer. From what took place at the mandatory disposition hearing and from what took place at the hearing, I think that reading is that through counsel. The defendant doesn't point to any cases that say a trial court has to explicitly communicate with the defendant about the plea offer. I think that's a problem.
I understand that, but wasn't there evidence? Was there evidence? Wasn't there evidence that Mr. Jatan had rejected those offers to his counsel? Now, I know counsel had said, I assume we talked about it and he rejected it. Is that weight versus admissibility of evidence? What is that?
I think so. I would have preferred certainly if the trial court had said, made some explicit findings on credibility as to the defendant, but the court sort of weighed them. And I think when you look at at defense counsel's testimony, that would have been my practice, and I assume I did that. And some of the other testimony was that when I talked with the defendant about these plea offers, he didn't like them. He thought they were outrageous. He did not deserve 20 years. When you look at that all together, I think that supports the trial court's determination here. If there are no further questions, I'd ask the court to affirm. Thank you.